Hello, and welcome to this podcast about general practice and the care of families of serving military personnel. This two-part episode is aimed at NHS GPs and their primary healthcare teams. We hope to highlight some of the issues facing service families and the implications this can have on their health, well-being and access to your services. And most importantly, we'll explore how you can best help and support them. I am Veronica Grant, an RCGP Veterans Clinical Champion and a GP. I've been a civilian medical practitioner for the Defence Medical Services, providing primary health care to military serving personnel and their families. I also have personal insight and experience as a military spouse through my husband, who was formerly serving as an army officer and is now a veteran. Happily, an increasing number of practices and primary healthcare teams are becoming veteran-friendly with improved understanding, recognition and signposting access to veteran-specific services. We now turn to serving military families and how we can help raise awareness and improve understanding of their unique lifestyle and some of the challenges faced. To help you understand the complexities of service life, my guests today are Jenny Ward from the Naval Families Federation, Karen Ross from the Army Families Federation, and Alison Cotton from the Royal Air Force Families Federation. If I could start by asking you all to introduce yourselves in more detail. Jenny.
Yes, thank you. My name's Jenny. I am the Covenant and Policy Advisor for the Naval Families Federation, and I'm also the Health Policy Lead. So the Naval Families Federation supports the serving community within the Royal Navy and Royal Marines.
And Karen, if I could hand over to you.
Hello, I'm Karen Ross, the AFF Health and Additional Needs Specialist. So I help support families through advocacy and empowerment and help them with any issues relating to health and additional needs.
And if I could hand over to Alison.
Hi, I'm Alison Cotton. I'm the Policy Advisor for Additional Needs and Health for the RAF Families Federation. We represent serving personnel, that's regular and reservists, and their families, and we lobby for change in policies that will better assist our serving families.
Families of serving military personnel are a diverse group, and for the purpose of our discussion today, we're focusing on the spouses and children as the immediate family unit, those who are greatest impacted by the military service and that unique lifestyle. Service families often experience extra pressure on family life. And Karen, I wonder if you might be able to elaborate more on this and provide some specific reasons why that might be the case.
Yes, there is a lot of stress related to military life. And that's not everyone that experiences that. And the three services do differ. There are some nuances between what areas people get stressed about. So frequent moves can create issues with suitable housing, suitable schools, spousal employment, and transferring health and social care. Army and RAF families tend to be more mobile than the Royal Naval and Royal Marines. The Royal Marines actually have increased separation. It was interesting actually from the FAMCAS UK Tri-Service Families Continuous Attitudes Survey for 2020. It did say that three quarters of spouses felt that frequency of operational tours is about right. However, this did vary amongst ranks, but the length of operational tours were considered often too long. The majority of those families were naval families.
Jenny, talking about naval families, would you like to elaborate a bit more about that and how that impacts on those families?
Yes, from a naval perspective, potentially you could be looking at serving personnel being away for 660 days over a rolling three-year period. So when you put that into context of, you know, how that affects family life, as Karen quite rightly said, of the duration of some of the deployments, we have guys who personnel who could be away for up to 9 months at a time. So for us, we do have mobile families. We do have families who move around the country. For a majority of our families who may live in their own home or close to a unit in those areas, it's more about the length of separation and also looking at the weekending, as they refer to it. So we have a lot of families who live across the country whose serving person, serving parent, partner is away during the working week. And again, looking at the impact that can have on physical and mental health for serving families.
So it's quite a significant difference in lifestyle to many of their civilian counterparts. And the things that you mentioned mainly about the extended periods of separation and long distance relationships. And I suppose that puts huge pressure on the spouses and potentially children as well of the serving personnel.
As Karen touched on earlier, we have families that have children with additional needs, disabilities and SEND. And looking at how those caring roles change within the family dynamic as people are away and back. You know, we talk to young people, young carers, where the young lad was the primary carer from Monday to Friday, and then parent came home at the weekend and his role changed. And it was looking at the impact that had on, you know, the whole family on a regular basis. And this can go on for some of our families for years, and especially when you look at something like submarine service, where those individuals are away on deployment. The communication is such a different thing, I think, for the civilian community to understand, is when they're away, the families can have two family grams going into the boat, which are open and which can be read, and there was no communication coming back out again. So if you're a family member dealing with a sudden illness, or as we've seen over the last 12 months with the pandemic, of having that serving person, that serving parent away for a lot extended periods of time can produce some additional challenges as well.
Thank you, Jenny. No, that makes perfect sense. Alison, I wonder if you would be able to tell us from an RAF perspective if there's any service-specific challenges faced by the families.
Yes, well, when the serving person gets deployed, and sometimes for the RAF, as probably for the Army too, this can be at short notice, the parent who's left behind suddenly becomes like a single parent, and all the caring responsibilities are left onto their shoulders. And they have to find other ways to get extra childcare or to find ways of coping. It's particularly been the case, as Jenny has said, with COVID. When you move, you've got to build up your support networks. And quite often our families aren't near their own families. They're living away. So they're isolated in that sense. And we've had some families tell us that they found it quite challenging with COVID, not being able to set up those social support networks. So that's been something really important to note.
Now that we've considered some of the challenges faced by service families, I think it's important to consider what's in place to help. The Armed Forces Covenant is in place to help counteract some of the potential disadvantages faced by service families. And Jenny, in your role as Policy and Covenant Advisor, I wonder if you're able to tell us a bit more about the Armed Forces Covenant.
As you say, the covenant is about removing disadvantage and levelling the playing field. I'm sure our families don't want to sort of jump queues and things like that. What they want is that when they are mobile, they should retain their relative place on any NHS waiting list. And I think those are the kinds of challenges often that we find with our families, is not only explaining how the covenant and the NHS constitution works to families, but also to healthcare providers as well. As I say, on the whole, they are a very resilient bunch. So when families do put their hand up and ask for help, what we often find is there's often a lot more behind it as well. And I think this is where the covenant and the NHS constitution is a great way forward.
I just wanted to pick up on the point that Jenny was making about the NHS constitution. That does have a section in it about the Armed Forces Covenant. However, it talks about no disadvantage in the area you live. Now, this is fine, but it's not really about when you're living in an area. It's about when you're moving in and out of an area constantly and the accumulative effect of that. So if you're receiving treatment in one area and then you move to another area and that treatment isn't provided, or you know, there's no commissioning policy around that, that can be problematic. There's also the accumulative effect of moving. Where is the Armed Forces Covenant? Currently, there's a commitment for the NHS waiting list time so that you retain your relative position on the NHS waiting list. That's quite often difficult to prove. And also, it doesn't really go far enough where people are transferring their ongoing healthcare. And that is the problematic area, because if you don't have anything to support where you are or what treatment you're having, and that can't be reintroduced in the new area, this is of concern for families.
So if there is disruption of care, or if they do have a position in a waiting list for secondary care or a procedure, what practical things can we do as GPs?
If you've got a condition where you've got a team in situ, something like cystic fibrosis, for example, they're quite good about contacting other teams in other areas to reinstigate the support available. But when you're just transferring other secondary healthcare requirements, you tend to have to go through your new GP to be re-referred into that system. And that can be problematic, particularly if GPs don't annotate that it's not a new referral, it's an ongoing referral. The other thing that's been tending to happen is that when GPs become aware that the family are moving, they say, well, there's no point putting you on the waiting list because there's no way you'll have an appointment for that assessment before you moved. However, if those families aren't put on a waiting list, how are they then going to prove their waiting list time and transfer it? So that's time lost. So I think that's really important to consider.
Totally agree with everything that Karen was saying. And in addition to that, I think it's really important that GPs ask families if they're serving families. We need to identify them in the very first instance so that we know that we need to follow the covenant. And it's important that if they are a service family and they've been on a waiting list for a service and they're about to move and be posted, and they'll need re-referred, that they're noted as a service family. So again, as Karen says, their time taken on the waiting list is taken into account in the new area so that they're not put at the bottom, which is what frequently happens, unfortunately.
So in terms of the military covenant that we've talked about and what that means for GPs and primary healthcare teams, I think it's really taking that on board, identifying those serving families and finding out more about their healthcare needs, their individual circumstances. Although some families of military personnel, depending on where they're based, they can access healthcare through the military system or the Defence Medical Services. By far, the vast majority of service families access their care through the NHS. And I wanted to bring this to you, Alison. What do you perceive are the barriers to families of military personnel in accessing NHS primary care?
Every time a family is posted, they have to register with a GP, find a dentist, so they have to start all over again. So be aware that in the case of single serving personnel, or where both parents are serving, if they have a child, then that child will need to be registered at an NHS GP practice, but their parent won't be. And this sometimes causes issues because there's a belief that you can't register a minor without a parent. However, there's an allowance for this, which allows a child from a service family to be admitted to a GP practice without having a parent being on the roll as well. Also, there's a delay in the transfer of records. So, for example, there are some DMS medical centres that family members can access, like the serving person. And if they were previously registered at a DMS GP practice, but now they're registering with a NHS GP practice, and the records have to be requested by the new NHS GP practice. And this can take some time. Similarly, the other way around, there's also a time delay if the service family has moved from the devolved administrations. So for example, it normally takes about 6 weeks for records to move between NHS Wales and NHS England. Another barrier that we've already talked about is the waiting list. The Armed Forces Covenant says that family members should retain their place on any NHS waiting list if moved around due to the service person being posted. So it's absolutely imperative that you identify the service family so that you can adhere to the covenant.
I think that it's really important, like Alison mentioned, that there's a way of identifying families. I think the understanding that this may be, I don't know, the sixth or seventh GP practice that you're registering at, as Alison's pointed out, it takes a while for notes to catch up, if they ever do, because obviously people move from overseas, devolved administrations, back into England, in and out of defence, medical service, medical centres, into civilian GP practices. That is quite intricate and can complicate issues. So I think just being mindful that if a family have got information or paperwork that they've collected together, that could help expedite sort of referral processes rather than waiting for their notes to catch up, and just being mindful that families may be repeating the same information. And I often speak to families and advise them to try and keep a portfolio of their medical letters and investigations, but also to think about, you know, getting plenty of medication if they're moving, in case they can't get a GP practice or get an appointment in a timely manner. And then there's the other issues where there's children who are on consultant prescribed only medication, you know, particularly for ADHD. That can be problematic as well, because, you know, you have to be referred back into a consultant to be able to be prescribed that medication. The GP can't do it in some areas, so that can be doubly difficult.
One way I think that GPs could help our service families is if they find out during an appointment that the family are to be posted and are moving, and they're accessing specialist care, they could start the ball rolling. The GP could, by starting those referrals either then, if the move is coming up, or at a date just before they move. I mean, I had a case recently with a family who the GP where they moved to was right on the ball and contacted them as soon as they registered and referred the family member that needed the specialist services right at that point of registration. And within 3 or 4 weeks, they had appointments to the specialist service that they required. So that was a GP that recognised that there was a service family with additional needs and was proactive and has staved off any issues arising through being proactive and putting those things in place straight away.
Oh, that sounds like a really positive example, Alison. Mm-hmm. One of the issues is the different experiences that serving military families have in terms of, you know, the diversity of where they're posted to, how frequent their relocations are, and also the awareness of the primary care team looking after them as well.
I think one of the things perhaps that GP practices could do is ask the question. I know when I moved to my current location, they asked a question about whether I was an armed forces veteran. But I think it'd be great if there could be a question of, are you part of an armed forces family? And to explain why that question is being asked. You know, with the covenant, which we talked about earlier, 10 years on, we still have families saying, well, why do I need to tell them? And sometimes that is for security reasons, because for generations, we just haven't talked about that we're part of this community. So I think it's to explain that we need this information, why, and to raise that awareness of, if you know that that person is part of a military family, of having awareness of what extra support is out there outside the NHS as well. So looking at third sector support. So within the Royal Navy, I think the RAF community as well, families can get access to free counselling services through Relate, which are provided by the charitable sector. So I think it's having GP practices aware of this kind of additional support, so that when they ask the question, then they can say to the family, we want to know this because there could be additional support. You know, we have various grant giving organisations as well that could perhaps assist if a family need additional equipment and things like that. And, you know, they need it quite quickly. These military charities can be very reactive as well.
Many families I work with have additional needs or disabilities, so they need their housing adaptations done. And if it's service families accommodation, then Defence Infrastructure Organisation will provide the adaptations through their processes. However, families often have to go to GPs for supporting documentation to justify that work. And I think it's just an understanding that that can be provided, so that families not being expected to jump through lots of hoops. I think at my GP practice, there's a lot of information for veterans, but then there's people who have served who work within that practice. So I think that's an important point as well, is that I think a lot of this work with the veteran-friendly accredited practices that's been going on is that there was always talk of preferring someone who knew what people were going through and understood that lifestyle and how that really helps support people, and they feel more confident to talk about it as well, as they feel they're going to be listened to and that there'll actually be some benefit from mentioning that you are part of that community.
I think that's a really important point, Karen, as well. I think from the perspective of providing a holistic healthcare, knowing a bit more and build and being able to build rapport by understanding and acknowledging that this is a service family and some of the challenges that that can bring. So we talked a bit about signposting to organisations. Jenny mentioned about some of the third sector organisations which are specifically available. I just wondered whether you're able to elaborate on that. Where can we signpost patients? Karen?
I think as organisations as well, the three family federations are really good at signposting to support that's out there specifically for the service community. Things like Together All, which was formerly the Big White Wall. You know, there's free access for serving personnel, veterans and their families if they're over 16. We've just linked up with the Veterans Covenant Hospital Alliance so that we've got links into secondary healthcare and that there's specific champions and leads within that umbrella that's going to be very useful moving forward. A lot of areas have also got specific armed forces champions in the local authority, and I think that's really good, not just for health and social care, but across the board. There's wider determinants of health. We will support families leaving the service for up to a year after service.
So there's a huge wealth of different resources and facilities available, which are tailored to service families for various different needs. And I suppose if we don't know who these families are, then we don't know to signpost them to these excellent services.
All three Families Federations have a facility where a family member or a serving personnel can raise an issue with this. So if they're having a difficulty in an area and they're not having any success with solving it, then they can raise an issue with us and we will do our best to move things forward for them.
I want to thank you all for your time today and to thank you for your ongoing support of the service families community and the fantastic work that you do.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Veronica. It's been a pleasure.
My thanks again to Jenny Ward from the Naval Families Federation, Karen Ross from the Army Families Federation, and Alison Cotton from the Royal Air Force Families Federation. You can find details about all three organisations by looking at the NHS website, www.nhs.uk/service families. Please listen to part two of this podcast when you'll hear what it's like to be in a military family trying to use NHS services, as well from a GP who has experience of caring for the families of serving military personnel.